KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
This doesn't feel like good news, though it kind of is. Prices not changing is a big relief from the constant climb we saw in the pandemic. Some of the changes are so small, blink and you miss it.
Yeah, I think Tropicana has shrunk its bottles. The price is pretty much the same, but the bottle is smaller.
Tropicana did not comment, but this is classic shrinkflation, and the reason why I focused mainly on the price per unit. Not just how much the bottle of juice costs, but what's the cost of an ounce of juice in that bottle. And here I get into a dilemma, holding a roll of aluminum foil.
Reynolds wrap, nonstick.
I calculate the savings is less than a penny per square foot. Does it count? I need help.
Can I ask your advice? Sorry, are you busy?
Pat Perkins, shopping for bread, ponders if a penny for each foot of foil counts as a price cut.
I don't think so, but you know it may add up after so many. Every little bit adds up.
Every penny counts, and this approach means more things for my shopping cart. I get to add flour and sugar, which are cheaper by a cent or two per pound. Then I reach the freezer with seafood, where I find a bag of pink salmon that's dropped in price.
Looks like I'm having salmon for dinner. It's 2 pounds of salmon.
In the meat section, I find the only thing that's gotten cheaper is boneless pork chops.
Dinner of champions, pork and pink salmon. Surf and turf in some land.
In the end, exactly half the items I shopped did not change in price over a year. The total count of things that got cheaper, 21 items. Of my list, that's just over a fifth.
Thank you. Let's tally up the loot.
Bagels and fruit for breakfast and for dinner. Beans, potatoes, and the strange surf and turf. Baked on foil. Alina Selyukh, NPR News, Savannah, Georgia.
And you can see the details of this price tracking project at npr.org/shoppingcart. And now it's time for sports. Championship weekend with NFL conference games and the Aussie Open. Roy Howard Brad of Better Lark Media joins us. Howard, thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning, Scott. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Big upset at the Australian Open. American Madison Keys won the women's single championship. She, of course, defeated the top-ranked Aryna Sabalenka of Belarus. Three sets. How'd she do it?
Well, she did it by playing the most fearless and error-free tennis of her life. Aryna Sabalenka is a two-time champion coming in, heavy favorite as well, and Madison Keys has been known. She was the 21st seed and has been known, obviously, as a Grand Slam talent for years. She made the U.S. Open final and lost to Sloane Stephens back in 2017 and really has been plagued by massive power, massive inconsistency, and really, really terrible fits of nerves and consistency at the biggest moments, but not this week. For this tournament, when she played, she beat the number one and the number two seeds to win this championship. She faced a match point against Iga Swiatek in the semifinal, and then she plays Sabalenka and wins the first set and comes all the way through. What a great championship for her. What a moment. This is the difference between all these great players. It's really not talent. It's how you hold up in the biggest moments. And for the first time in her career at the top of the mountain, she got through. She crossed the line.
Men's final tomorrow. Of course, top-ranked Jannik Sinner of Italy is trying to repeat, but he's got a challenge, doesn't he?
Well, he's got a challenge, but once again, he's facing Alexander Zverev, who has been here before as well. This is his first Australian Open final, but he, in 2020, at the U.S. Open against Dominic Thiem, had a two-sets-to-love lead in a best-of-five, needed one set to win, lost three sets in a row. Again, at the French Open, he was up 2-1 against Carlos Alcaraz and couldn't cross the line either. Once again, just like Madison Keys, Alexander Zverev is a huge talent, 6'6", has got all of what it takes, but hasn't quite been able to put it together as the altitude gets really thin. Let's see what he can do against the world number one.
NFL Conference Championship games tomorrow. Winners go to the Super Bowl first. Philadelphia Eagles host the Washington Commanders. Philly has a dominant defense, punishing running attack. DC has a first-year coach and a rookie quarterback who's been golden so far. What do you foresee?
Well, Jaden Daniels has been spectacular. What a year for Washington. They finally, you say goodbye to Daniel Snyder in the second year away from the game after the team gets sold, and now you're four quarters away from the Super Bowl. Once again, this, you know, pro football playoffs always come down to two things, Scott: injuries and turnovers. And if you're healthy and you protect the ball, usually the better team wins. Philadelphia is not healthy. Jalen Hurts, the quarterback, we're not sure about how he's feeling. Washington has this unbelievable sort of cardiac kids thing going on this year. NFC East rivals, let's see what they do. It's going to be great.
And, of course, the twice defending champion Kansas City Chiefs host the Buffalo Bills. This has become football's greatest rivalry, and I've been practicing something. Ready?
Oh, here
Fear
we go.
The Bison!
Fear the Bison. That is so bad, Scott. But they need all the help they can get, because no one knows if anyone can beat the two-time defending champion Chiefs. We've never seen a three-peat in the Super Bowl era. But I think Buffalo's the better team. Can they finally finish? Can anybody beat Patrick Mahomes? It's the same conversation we used to be having about Tom Brady. But Buffalo is the better team, but will they be the last one standing in the AFC?
Howard Bryant of Meadowlark Media. We'll look forward to those games. Thank you so much for being with us. Talk to you soon, my friend.
No, my pleasure. Thank you, Scott.
Two weeks ago, we spoke to Victoria Wilson and her 16-year-old daughter, Charlotte, whose family lost their home in the Los Angeles fires.
The hardest things for us is, like, the things you can't replace.
It reminded me that, like, not everything is gone, and, like, I can still be with my friends when I want to.
A few days ago, they were allowed back to see their neighborhood to take a look at the place they love, and they graciously shared what they saw and felt with us.
It's Monday, January 20th, and we are preparing to go see the remains of our house that was burned down in the Eaton Fire on January 8th. And I'm really nervous for myself, for my kids.
I forgot, it's fine, let's just go.
So we're in the car, we're all a little tense, unsure what to expect. Yeah, we've been yelling at each other. Just the further north we drive, the more my heart rate goes up. I mean, it looks like a bomb got dropped here. Yeah, I can see that. Oh my God. There's the gym, it's okay.
Oh, well, there's that karate.
That karate studio's gone. Oh, my
just
God.
Hey, put a stop
all
to
these
it.
Houses it's are totally gone.
For sure. It's okay,
it
looks like it's...
Yeah, this will go all the way to our street. This is unrecognizable, right?
Yeah, no, I have no idea where we are.
It looks like a war zone.
Yep. So we just arrived at the remains of our house. Next door looks the same as it did when we left. For all I know, Michelle could walk out and wave to me over the fence, but I know they're not there. Oof. The walls caved in on the driveway. I'm saving my turtle sculpture. Citrus trees are all burned. All the lemons and limes and oranges that I like to come out and pick. Go
through everything. I mean, I don't want someone going through this for me. What is this? Now there's some paint stuff over here. Oh my god. Oh my god, that's paint. Oh my god, there's still paint in here. I just wish I was up here alone. I mean, I can't have people. I just need to, like, take it in for myself.
And I guess this was the office. So, somewhere under that piece of roof is the remains of the desk, and it's so hard to orient yourself in the rubble. Even though we lived in this house for a dozen years. I'm gonna walk across the street and see what it looks like. Jeez. It's just so bizarre. They only got a yellow tag. The rest of us have red tags on our houses. As far as you can see down the street, red, red, red. It's just wackadoodle.
Victoria Wilson and her daughter, Charlotte Wilson, whose family returned to their Altadena neighborhood this week to go through the remains of their home.
Weekend Edition is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Like a story you heard on this or another NPR program? Share it with a friend at npr.org. While there, you can also hear stories you missed, enjoy expanded content, or connect to your favorite member station.
And you're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. When TikTok looked doomed in the U.S., many users quickly signed up for another Chinese-owned app called Xiaohongshu in protest. It's known as Red Note in English. What happened next was a surprise, as NPR's Owen Tsao reports.
TikTok refugees, that's how American users are describing themselves as a connect with the Chinese community on Red Note. Until last week, the app was mainly used in China. However, frustration over a potential ban has led many TikTok users to switch to Red Note.
I'm a female farmer, so of course I convinced my husband to let me get pigs for Valentine's Day last year.
31-year-old Tyler Ross is one of them. Her day job is in human resources, but she also posts videos on Red Note of her life on a farm in Central Virginia. She says her lifestyle is far from the typical image of American farming, and the response she's got has exceeded her expectations.
It's, I think, interesting to see people's reaction when they only know things from the media or TV, to see different types of ways of doing things. So everyone's been super friendly. They all love our animals.
The videos of chickens and dogs she posts gained her 18,000 followers within 2 days of starting her account.
Once all of the chickens have had their breakfast,
I now, a week later, that number has nearly tripled, surpassing her TikTok followers. Lizzie Shen, a teacher from Eastern China, is one of Ross's new followers. She shared a picture of her own garden in the comments. She says that seeing videos on Red Note has given her a strong connection to ordinary Americans. There used to be a barrier between the two countries, but now real connections are building goodwill. Many Chinese users are sharing memories of their English classes at school, where they were often asked to write letters to imaginary American pen pals. Now, they're hearing from real friends writing back.
It's kind of like the digital Berlin Wall moment.
This is Olivia Plotnick, founder of Y Social, a social media marketing agency in Shanghai. She says that China's censorship of platforms like Facebook and Instagram has made it harder for Chinese and Americans to communicate. While TikTok has separate versions for China and the US, Red Note users are on the same platform in both countries.
And now they're able to come together with no middleman and talk talk and communicate directly with each other.
But she warns that RedNote's unified platform is likely to face scrutiny from the authorities in China, and the surge of American users adds new challenges.
It doesn't comply with government internet regulations, and it doesn't comply with Western users' expectations. So at some point, somebody's going to clash and butt out.
David Craig, an associate professor of communication at USC Annenberg, agrees, pointing out that it's hard for influencers to make money on RedNote.
I do think that it's still very difficult to imagine that it will be more than a short-lived trend. For example, Xiaohongshu isn't really set up to support and fund creators in the U.S.
He says that he believes the magic and fascination will eventually fade, which looks more likely now that President Trump has paused the ban on TikTok. But RedNote has already formed some new international connections. Tyler Dock, a RedNote user from the Bay Area, says he's amazed by the genuine conversations with Chinese users on the app. He even downloaded Duolingo to start learning Mandarin.
I can definitely say that I've thought about visiting China more in the last 3 days than I probably have the rest of my life. All my life combined.
And just like that, one potential ban has opened a new window, bringing people together in unexpected ways. What comes next remains to be seen. Alwyn Cao, NPR News, Beijing.
This is NPR News.
Fall River, Massachusetts has an infamous murder case that happened long before Lizzie Borden, a young woman found dead on a cold winter day. But did she name her killer?
There's this ominous note that she wrote and she locked in a trunk.
A new book on the death of Sarah Cornell, The Sinners All Bow, Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
I'm Louise Schiavone with these headlines. Four Israeli female soldiers taken hostage in a Hamas incursion into southern Israel October 7, 2023, have returned to Israel. They were handed over to representatives of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Gaza this morning. They were freed as part of a deal mediated by the U.S., Qatar, and Egypt. Israel has released 200 Palestinians from prison as part of a hostage-for-prisoner swap in the framework of the ceasefire deal with Hamas that went into effect last Sunday in the Gaza War. The Israeli Prison Service released profiles of some of those freed, including some serving multiple life sentences for shooting attacks and assisting in the commission of suicide bombings. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BetterHelp, committed to making mental well-being a priority and offering support in taking on everything life demands, with therapists available to communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public. And from Progressive Insurance, working to help protect small businesses and the owners that run them, offering customizable coverages to salons, accounting firms, tradespeople, and more. Learn more at ProgressiveCommercial.com. This is NPR.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Mauro Del Perro's film, Vermiglio, won the Grand Jury Prize at the Venice Film Festival. It is set in an isolated Italian village in the Alps in 1944, where two deserters show up. Attilio, who's from the village, and Pietro, who was from Sicily. Attilio's extended family lets Pietro sleep in their barn, and soon a relationship with Lucia, the family's eldest daughter, goes beyond glances and sighs. Mauro Del Perro joins us now from Argentina, where she lives much of the year. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hello. Thank you for inviting.
Tell us about Attilio's large family. who wind up being at the center of so much of this film, beginning with Cesare, the stern village school teacher, but he has a soft side, doesn't he?
He is one of the most contradictory characters, I think. All the family is inspired by my family, by the family of my father. Of course, the family of my grandfather was interesting because my grandfather was both a father and the teacher of the town. At that time, a teacher of a little village was a very important person. Of course, it's a kind of a different family, but at the same time, it's a typical family of the rural society of that time, in which there's a mother who doesn't stop having children and never steps out of a kitchen, and then there are more kids than beds, and there are a lot of secrets and a lot of stories, because everyone is an individual, but everyone is also part of a community. So this was one of the aspects that interested me more.
I do want to ask you about just an utterly beautiful scene when Cesare, who seems to be an imperious, almost crusty schoolteacher, I think literally weeps when he plays Vivaldi for the youngsters in his classes in his school. What's being unlocked in his heart?
I think, to me, there's really a deep love for culture and the faith that culture can be a response to the nihilism of war. He's kind of an anti-militarist. He has the strength to say in front of the other peasants that maybe cowardice is a good thing. It's one of his beautiful aspects. And of course, he also has bad aspects. But in his contradictions, I think one of the things we love him for is that we all would like to have a teacher like this for our children.
So much is conveyed in this film, in the sights and the sounds. The softness, in a sense, the flickering candles, the braying goats, the milk sloshing in a pail.
To me, it's audiovisual. Audiovisual is an important word. We have to always think that we hear as much as we see. And I believe sound is a really interesting tool. And I felt from the very beginning that silence would have been the most important sound of the film, because it was not just a matter of the period film and the fact that it's not our frenetic world. It was also a matter of space, not just time. The space is the mountains, those high mountains, and also the music, the choice of the music, like privileging the diegetic music and not putting a soundtrack from outside. I felt that the film had its own music. Based on whispers, based on the songs that the peasants sing and the music the father listens to. So even if we can hear it anticipated in one scene or a following scene inherits it, the music always comes from the source, the real source, which is the gramophone of the father.
Yeah. What I'll refer to as a scandal becomes part of the story. In a village like Vermiglio, are there really any secrets?
Yeah, of course. There were a lot of secrets. But the fact is that there is always also this protection, this fear of being ashamed in front of the other villagers. So, for example, when the tragedy happens to Lucia, the aunt is more worried about what will people say than what is happening to her. Here in Argentina, there's a sentence that says, little village, big hell. Villages hide a lot of secrets and no one can tell them, also because it's dangerous to have them.
I'm not sure I could ever live in a village like Vermiglio. Am I missing something?
I think you are gaining a lot of freedom, and you are losing a lot of protection. I think Lucia is also a metaphor of what happened in society in those years. this passage from the village to the city, from the rural to the industrial, more individual and more individualistic.
Marta Del Perro's new film, Vermiglio, Grand Jury winner at the Venice Film Festival, is now showing in select U.S. theaters. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you to you. Thank you for inviting.
Betty Shumia is the author of 15 plays, but when she began to write her first book, she wanted to create something truly different, kind of a Palestinian-American Sex in the City, where the main character tries to distance herself from her heritage until...
The only offer she gets, which is, you know, not an offer she wants, is to go to Ramallah, which is her hometown, and direct a cross-dressing production of Hamlet. And the only reason she takes it is because a British theater company is going to finance it. And so it's not this story of like her coming home to, you know, confront the issues of the past and her ghosts. It's her trying to like get her one last shot.
Betty Shumia on her new novel, Too Soon, and how heritage, relationships, and ambition can all collide. Later today on Weekend, All Things Considered, you can listen by telling your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. Bonnie Reichert, the writer and chef, was 5 years old, sitting on her father's lap at the dinner table in Edmonton, Canada, and savoring the last bits of a salad of cucumbers, tomatoes, and fresh dill when she noticed something colorful on her father's arm.
I saw some numbers. They were bluish, greenish. I remember the moment perfectly. Daddy, what's this? And he said, oh, some bad man put that on me. And I scrubbed him with the napkin. I said, take this off. And he said, those numbers don't come off. And I said, where are the bad men now? And he said, don't worry, the bad man ran away.
Bonnie Reichert's father, Solomon Saul, is a survivor of the Holocaust, and in her new memoir, she comes to terms with the ways in which food has been mileposts in her family's life. Her memoir, How to Share an Egg. And Bonnie Reichert joins us from the studios of the CBC in Toronto. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. What a pleasure to be here.
You grew up in a food family, a family in the food business in Edmonton, didn't you?
Yes, I did. We had restaurants. My grandmother also was a tremendous cook and also worked with my dad, her son-in-law, in our restaurants. So if we weren't going to have dinner with my dad, we were going to pick up my bubba, or sometimes I even got to help her in the restaurant, in the kitchen.
I want to bring in the voice of your father.
This is Saul Reichert recording for NPR on December 29th, 2024.
Saul just turned 94, and he had this memory of his first hours of freedom after Auschwitz.
Go ahead.
We were hiding in a barn under a pile of straw. And then finally, we left the barn and we went down to find out that the Americans already arrived. We were free. Oh my God. I went down and I said, oh my God, I'm free, I'm going to live. So we were out in the street and we had no food. So we started looking for food. So we knocked in the barn. Would you give us some food? They said, we can only give you one egg. One egg for two people. I said, how do we share that?
And of course, the story of that egg becomes the title of your book. And what role did food begin to play in your life as you look back on it now?
Food was everything in my family. So my father had almost starved in especially the Lodz ghetto, and I depict that in the book, you know, that people are sitting on a bench and he thinks that they're skeletons and then one of them moves. He said the shock of that famine never left him. So I was raised by this person who had to survive on potato peels and coffee grounds. And he was very, you hear it in that clip, very grateful for what he had, and brought a real sense of wonder and joy.
I want to get you to talk about a couple of specific foods. I mean, the borscht of your life in Warsaw, that's not an easy story.
The borscht was such an uncanny moment, because we were in Warsaw. I was with my father, my mother, and my sister. I had been brought up to say, I'm not going to Poland. I'm not going to look at the camps. My dad would say, I suffered enough. You don't have to suffer. We're not going to go. And then all of a sudden, he changed his mind because a relative told him that there was a tomb in the Jewish cemetery in Warsaw, which is an incredible, incredible place. There was a tomb that was a family tomb. And the tomb ended up being his grandfather's tomb. And I said to myself, great, we're done. That's wonderful. We did what we came to do. I had a headache. It was raining. I wasn't enjoying being in Warsaw. It's like, fantastic. We're going to go home now. And we stopped at a restaurant. Everything was closed. It was the middle of the afternoon. And our guide said, here's something open. And it was the most dubious looking restaurant. It was empty. It was full of cigarette smoke. And I'm expecting, you know, some greasy old food, you know, something, or hot dogs. I didn't know what to expect. And out of the kitchen comes this beautiful, beautiful borscht. It's beet red, crisp and clear. And then these beautiful fresh garnishes, chopped cucumber, sour cream, fresh dill. And this bowl of borscht spoke to me and reminded me that my roots are in Poland. So it was, the hairs on the back of my neck are standing up just talking about it.
What do stews mean to you, Choland?
Stew was such a funny thing in our house because stew was my mother's most hated dish. My mother grew up poor in Canada and felt that stew was poor people food and didn't want to have anything to do with it. On the other hand, stew was my father's most beloved dish because when he was a child, he ate a stew called, as you said, cholent. And this was a special stew that his mother made for the Sabbath. So she would make it on Friday afternoons. And then because you couldn't turn your oven off or on in the old country, in the little village that my father grew up in, All of the women would take their cholents and walk them to the community oven, to the bakery. They would slide their prepared cholents into the community oven and leave it there overnight and then pick them up on Saturday afternoon. And my father used to talk about cholent all the time when I was a child. My mother's cholent was the best. Everybody in the building knew that we had the most delicious cholent. Everyone could smell it. And yet, nobody made it. And while I was writing the book, I came to feel that this dish was so mythical and carried so much significance that nobody wanted to touch it. But I, foolish girl, I touched it. I decided to make it.
What's in a cholent?
It's beans and barley and a little bit of meat, depending on how much meat they had in the olden days, how much money there was for them to get meat. And it all goes into a pot with a lot of water. And in my first attempt, I did not put enough water. My father warned me to put, because it cooks for a very, very long time. And when you open it the next day, the meat should be very tender and the water absorbed and all of the beans and barley nicely plump and ready to be eaten.
You know, we call your father a survivor, and he is. But it certainly occurred to me on the last page, his life has been a good deal richer than just surviving.
Yes, he will mention in passing what happened to him during the war, but it's not something that he goes back to over and over again. He's not stuck. You know, I write about his sense of wonder, and I felt so happy that I could figure out how to describe that, because he is an amazingly optimistic person. He's a person that loves joy and fun and pleasure. He, at 94, still says to me, what are we doing for fun? Where are we going? Let's go out for dinner. And so he has lived a beautiful life, despite what happened. Or maybe he figured out how to make something beautiful after what happened.
Bonnie Reichert's new memoir, How to Share an Egg. And thank you so much for sharing the story with us.
Thank you. I loved it.
And this is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at Viking.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.